Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to the final game podcast of the season. We're so excited that this is our last podcast that, as a special occasion, we have not one, not two, not three, but four guests in the studio. One of them uninvited. I'll let you guess which one. Among our invited guests are Alison Rudd, who, of course, won the listeners poll as favorite podcast guest this season. Also, we have Matt Hughes, everybody's favorite Huddersfield supporter, and making his way down from the far north, that is Anfield, it's Julian Lawrence. Also with us is Rory Smith, who returned quickly from his nuptials, right?
Yeah.
Couldn't wait to get back, could you?
I have a job to do.
Exactly.
I'm on holiday forever.
Exactly. I'll let you guys guess who the unexpected guest was. We'll be talking a bit of FIFA, but first, let's talk about the FA Cup and its enduring magic. Matt, he starts Theo Walcott over Olivier Giroud up front, and obviously he wins 4-0, Walcott scores, so it's all good. I don't think Olivier Giroud is as horrible a player as many people suggest. I really don't. And I especially don't understand this idea that Giroud's not there. I play Walcott. I mean, totally different skill set. I don't think Walcott's a long-term answer at centre forward. But hey, what's your take?
Giroud is not as bad as people think, but he's not as good as some other people say either. I think he's a very good centre forward with limitations. I think it was as simple as Wenger picking the man in form, which happened to be Theo Walcott. Giroud's looked tired last few months. Theo's got a hat-trick the week before. It was a pragmatic decision to pick him, and it paid off.
Maybe Wenger just knew it didn't really matter who he picked.
Yeah, that was kind of my thing, because if you play Walcott instead of Giroud, then the way you play becomes different, right?
Yeah, but this is not a manager who sort of strategises and picks looks at games as a sort of a battle and thinks about the best way to win. He just kind of picks the players he likes, isn't he? He's quite old-school in that respect.
Is it usually, is that not very tactical, just kind of picks the guy you want, because guy put on your bibs, go out there?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
Well, a little bit. I'm being slightly facetious, but he's not Jose Mourinho. He doesn't pick a team for a specific opponent. He picks what he would regard to be his
well, I know,
his best
team. Giroud's been his starter all year, right?
When sure, but he's not been playing particularly well, and he's been tired because he's been, since November, he's played pretty much every game.
Mm.
And as last season, it's caught up with him. Last season he started in August and played till about January, February, had those issues and looked exhausted. And it's been the same this year, really. He came back and was really good, but he's looked knackered the last couple of months.
Yeah, he hadn't scored for eight games before Saturday, Giroud. So you know, there's a sense, like Matt said, that he picked Walker, who was more informed with the hat-trick the week before. I think, you know, he thought that the pace of Walker would be very useful in that game, and I think it was, but they could even have used him even better, and because Villa played with such a high line at the back, I thought it was completely stupid from them and from Sherwood to have that game plan in place, and credit to Wenger if he saw it coming.
Anybody want to defend Sherwood and his high line and the logic behind it? I'm looking at you, Rory. Beyond even your powers.
No, I thought it's easy to kind of overanalyze these things, isn't it? Basically, Arsenal are a lot better than Villa. Arsenal played, I think the commentator said they brought their A game, which is just about true. I don't think they needed to bring their A game for more than 40 minutes, to be honest. Villa had nothing. I guess Sherwood's thinking would have been play high, press Arsenal off out of the ball, out of possession, disrupt their rhythm, might work. You could maybe make a case for him saying that it doesn't really matter how Aston Villa defend against Arsenal, the chances are they're going to get found out either way. So maybe that he thought that was his best way of taking the game to them. But it looked to me like Villa basically didn't turn up. I think they froze on the occasion, and it wouldn't really matter how they played, they were going to get beaten.
Did I imagine it? I really honestly thought Sherwood said he had a tactical surprise up his sleeve before the game. He did say that, didn't he? Did anyone else hear him say that?
I think so, yeah.
I couldn't work out what it was.
It's Grealish. Well, it was Ogbia.
Maybe we're still waiting for it. Maybe it'll come,
next week.
Villa Park next season.
Putting Alan Hutton on Alexis Sanchez is genius.
Team Sherwood knows he's rubbish tactically. Yeah, we all know that. Just go back to basic. It's a cup final. Just make sure you don't concede at least for 75 minutes and try to nick a goal on the set piece. Something. Don't just to do something like completely stupid like that. I just don't understand.
So you want Sherwood to be negative rather than up and at him?
No, I want Sherwood to try to win.
You want Sherwood to shrink back and cower?
I want Sherwood to try to win the bloody game. Not doing something fancy because he fancies himself a bit of a tactical genius and just go, yeah, listen, I've got that. This is how we're going to win the game. Just press high and leave 40 yards between your back four and your 52-year-old goalkeeper, and that's going to be fine. We're going to win. Come
on. Playing in Zodby instead of Antoine Lahore was baffling. Totally baffling.
Crazy. Even Westwood ahead of Carlos Sanchez, for me, was like, made no sense. And then you brought him on at 3-0 down.
He's a game changer, isn't he?
Defensively.
We've talked a lot of Sherwood. Some of us have even given him some love because he's clever for a footballer and for a former footballer, and he'll come good one day, although sometimes you see games like this FA Cup final and it was pretty awful. Tim Sherwood, I mean, you know him better than all of us, Matt, given your past together. Okay, yeah, he's blushing, he's denying it now. But I always imagine, you know, after a loss, some managers go and they analyze everything back. They say, what could I have done differently? What could I have done better? Do you think he's sitting here right now Monday morning and he stayed up all night? He's all bleary-eyed because he stayed up all night rewatching the video and consulting with his staff. Or do you think he's just like, meh, it's gone. They're better than we are anyway. So
His response on Saturday was pretty much blame his players. There were almost echoes of that extraordinary press conference at Stamford Bridge when Chelsea beat them and he completely slaughtered the Spurs players. On Saturday at Wembley, he just dropped into the press conference that I've told half the team they're leaving, which is absolutely extraordinary. He's not got much money to spend. He'll sell Benteke and use that to strengthen throughout the squad, but he's going to have to take that, whatever, 25, 30 million and use it to buy five or six players.
I'm baffled by the list of players he's told that are leaving. Like, I think we have to accept that. So Villa don't have very many good footballers. That's probably fair to say. Villa, there's this thing about Villa like having like quite a good side and they're not where they should be. I've seen Villa a lot this season. They're really bad. They've got some bad players.
Are you suggesting we're overrating the likes of Delph and Benteke and Flahr? I mean, are those the guys?
They're kind of all okay, all of them. Benteke, yeah, fine. But he kind of said, so in Ollie Kay's piece, or is it Ollie, or is it Gary who's written it? I can't remember. Sissoko, fine, terrible. Philip Senderos, fine, terrible. He's going. Matthew Loughton, he's okay. Is Matthew Loughton the problem at Aston Villa? I don't know if he is.
Hasn't played in a while.
Andy Vyman. Of all the players at Villa, why would you look at Andy Vyman and think, you are the one I want rid of? And
he never played him, did he?
Really don't get it. It's Carlos Gil. Gil came in January and was really good. And then Sherwood obviously decided he didn't like him.
He scored that great goal.
No, I saw his debut. I saw a couple of games from Gil. He had something about him. He's not kind of one of those players at Villa you think, oh yeah, he's definitely not. I don't understand Tim Sherwood's players he wants rid of selection. It baffles me.
Who would you get rid of?
I wouldn't get rid of Sherwood. I agree with Sherwood. I think Sherwood's okay. I think he's a mid-table manager. I think he's fine for Villa.
Well, he's done a good, you know, he's come in and done his job, really.
Yeah, they kind of tailed off a bit.
Kept them up and got them to a cup final. He's exceeded expectations, so he deserves a season or two to show what he can do.
I'm not saying I'd get rid of Sherwood. I'm just saying I'm surprised that he's looked at that squad and looked at the three or four of those players and thought they have to go.
Did he tell Ollie, like, oh, these are the guys I need to get rid of?
Gary Jacob, I think we should do.
Did he tell Gary Jacob?
King of the transfer market, Gary.
Is it one of those things where, like,
we do not question Gary Jacob's information?
No, but obviously there's a difference between you know, making that information come out and coming out and saying it in public, right?
If I can just make a point about Jack Grealish, not just because he partied after the defeat until very early in the Sunday morning, but I was very disappointed. And
you
think
you shouldn't be partying after a defeat? You think you should be going home?
Yeah,
because that's going to help you win the game after.
Especially with his, you know, link with the club and how much he loves the club and everything. I don't think. Anyway, he's young and he fancied going out with the Arsenal boys and all of that. So fair enough. But I was very disappointed by his game. And the other day, I went to the Nike Town with my son, my 6-year-old Raphael, to get him the new front shot, and we saw Jack Grealish at the Nike Town. Being there for people to see him, he was trying to catch everybody's eyes for people to recognize him and see him. And my son said,
"Well, he has a deal with Nike, doesn't he?"
I assume so. I assume so.
He was paid
bags
to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. No.
It's
no.
Like
yeah.
He was
yeah
just
sorry,
doing
he was shopping. No, he was shopping.
Is this the Nike Town at Oxford Circus?
Yes.
You went to Nike Town at Oxford Circus.
Yeah, my son loved it there to buy him his new French shirt.
What day was it?
Thursday.
That's all right.
It was a Thursday after school. He loved it. He has Varane on the back. Number 4. He was very happy. And then he spotted Grealish before me, even. He said, "Look, that's Jack Grealish," who was trying to interact with everybody who was there with his shopping done, everything. Anyway, and my son said, "Is Jack Grealish any good? Do we like him?" And I said, "Well, I think he's got potential, but I'm not sure. People in this country make him like he's the next Messi and they want him in for England and all of that. I'm not so sure." I said to him, "Let's see in the cup final if he's any good or not." So we were on Grealish watch on Saturday from the stands. And the first few balls, obviously, was bad from Grealish. So I said at some point, "Oh, Grealish, rubbish." And the rest of the game, every time Grealish touched the ball and did something bad, which he did most of the time, my son shouted, "Grealish, rubbish! Grealish, rubbish!" Which I thought was so funny and everybody cracked up. And I was very disappointed
about
Jack Grealish.
It's always funnier when it's your
Saturday
own child.
I liked that story. But I would also say that, is Grealish 19 or 20? 19.
He's ridiculously young. Whatever.
No, he's not ridiculously young. Hector Bellerin is 20. Now, if you, and obviously the different positions, I'm not comparing the way they play, but if you look at the composure and the calm and the smoothness with which Bellerin has adapted to first-team football and played on that stage, you compare that to Grealish, Bellerin is light years ahead of him in his development. I agree with Jules. I think Grealish is clearly talented.
Yeah, there's something.
But the hype around him is slightly ridiculous.
Yeah, that England talk baffled me.
Because he had
me
one great game and in a cup semi-final at Wembley, it's not a surprise that he's been hyped and it's over the top.
All right, enough Villa. Let's go back to Arsenal for a second. This is Wenger's 6th FA Cup win, which allows him to draw level alongside somebody named Ramsey. Not Alf, but some other bloke from a long, long time ago. And I confess is it George Ramsey? George.
Yes.
Manager of Aston Villa.
Okay.
It was between like 1897 and...
Did he introduce pasta and chicken to England as well?
He invented broccoli.
I'm wondering, is Wenger going to be one of those guys that we don't appreciate enough? And when he's gone, we'll be like, "Oh, look, he was actually really good." He won't just be the answer to a trivia question.
No, undoubtedly, when Wenger eventually goes, there will be a lot said about how great he was. And the longer the distance between his retirement point and when we're speaking about him, the greater a figure in football he will become. Unless he's winning everything all the time, he's going to come in for criticism.
I don't quite get this Wenger underappreciated. He's kind of universally revered in the media, particularly. I can't think of any manager who's admired and respected as much in this country. And I think that's particularly extraordinary, given...
You haven't spoken to Duncan Castles, have you?
Lack of achievement. I meant the media as a whole, not one maverick individual journalist. I don't think Mourinho is right in his assassination of Wenger, but he's right to say that any other club would not tolerate 9 years without a trophy. And the fact that Wenger has done so, with relatively small amounts of criticism, I think is remarkable and is a testament to him. So I don't see him being underappreciated at all.
I agree with Hughesy, but I think there is a point at which Wenger stopped being, not overappreciated, but stopped being, revered is probably the right word, and became just another manager. And I think that might be what is reassessed when he does retire, that there will be a point at which people say, actually, do you know what, for all that he was flawed and he didn't do everything perfectly, obviously, that maybe he wasn't just another manager.
The philosophy, the class, everything is just him, and he's got... I think the club now is all his input, and I think that's fantastic. And I think it was a good club before, but like you said, he was nowhere near the club it is now, and that's, thanks to him. And maybe he could have gone before and someone else would have come in and it would still be the same, because I think once the DNA is there, it will stay even after him. But I think that... And a lot of fans... tend to forget, that's the essence of fans, tend to forget where the club was in 96 when he took over Bruce Ryan. You know, the club was like very, very average at the time. And, you know, it not just brought success, but the stadium, like Alison said, the training grounds, the academies, the like we said, the philosophy, the image of it, the brand, everything is just, I think it's fantastic, and that's down to him.
Yeah, there's no doubt that he is, as an architect of a football club, he probably stands alone. For Alex Ferguson did something similar, but from a much higher base, because United had the history, tradition, big stadium kind of already. And obviously he took that to another level. I think the frustration amongst Arsenal fans, and I think it's understandable, is that he could have done more on the pitch. The question is whether he can, over the next 5 years, take them to the next level where they're really amongst the champions elite. To do that, he probably needs to be a bit more ruthless and spend money.
Maybe.
Again, I was discussing this yesterday with someone else, comparing how he used to be so ruthless in the transfer market. He used to get rid of the players like Vieira, Perez, Henri, even when they were on the turn, he got red. Now he indulges them. He's going to give new contracts to Arteta, Flamini, Rizicki, Abu Dhabi. Really should not still be at Arsenal.
Well, come on now. Just because this complete.
He's played for 10 years. The point I was trying to make was he used to be very good at recycling, refreshing the team in the manner of Ferguson. I don't think he has done that this year. Instead of going out and buying a great midfield player, he will probably get by with Coquelin and hand contracts to Arteta and Flamini as reserves. And well, I think to take them on, he needs to be more ruthless and ambitious in the transfer market.
We're going to move on in a minute. I had one question about the striker situation, because reading the media, listening to the punditocracy, people seem to agree, oh, they need a big-name striker. Judging from your face, they're not going to get that.
That's how we judge all of our transfer rumours at the Times, is we run them past Matt Hughes' face.
You have Walcott, who I presume they're not going to ditch unless they sign Sterling. You have Danny Welbeck, who is an England star, but people seem to have forgotten all about him. And he likes playing striker. He doesn't really like playing on the wing so much. And you have Giroud.
And Sanchez.
Yeah, but yes.
Sanchez wants to play centre-forward.
The switch between Walcott and Sanchez at Wembley, 37th minute, 3 minutes later, they score a goal from Walcott on the left wing and Sanchez flicking the ball in the centre. And I think they should have done the switch.
Sanchez isn't a viable centre forward for a whole Premier League season, is it?
No, but you've just named four people who can play centre forward. I wouldn't say. My favourite transfer rumour of all time is the Arsenal want another striker to complement Olivier Giroud. They don't have to spend €70 million on Edinson Cavani.
Because he's a natural complement.
Exactly, yeah.
He's a natural complement for Ibra.
I wouldn't have said that Arsenal, with those four options, as you say, if they get Sterling and Walcott goes, then maybe it changes a little bit. But with those four options, I wouldn't have thought if kind of a Benzema's available, then maybe that changes it. But I can't. I think Hughes is dead right. Wenger is always loyal to the players he's got.
Okay, so sorry, I just want to understand. So they're not going to sign a defensive midfielder, and they're not going to sign a centre forward. A centre half, maybe?
Well, then I think they desperately need a centre half. But
it's not like they signed one in January.
Two weeks ago, Wenger was saying, "Oh well, we've buckled there. We've got Monreal. We've got Chambers." So he might not sign anyone.
Yeah, no.
They really need a goal.
If he does, he'll probably sign another attacking midfielder guy, right? Another little tricky guy, because they don't have enough of those.
No, he's going to go for a defensive midfielder, surely.
Yeah, he will.
He will.
Yeah, he
but
will.
Hughesy said that he won't.
No, I think it might not be Schneider.
Schneider's going to United.
Yeah,
he?
French television last night said that he was very close from signing to United.
Was it the reliable French television, or was it the crappy one?
Yeah, the reliable.
No, because.
The reliable.
As the former Paris Saint-Germain coach says, you guys have, like, when it comes to football, you guys have the worst qualities of all the countries around you. Worst qualities of the Germans, the worst qualities of the English, the worst qualities of the Spanish, and the worst qualities of the Italians. Right? I always take it with a grain. Cum grano salis, as they say. Right, who wants to talk about FIFA and corruption? Let's all make a joke about Jack Warner. I think it's hilarious. I invite you all, when you're finished, or you can even do it while you're listening to us, go to Jack Warner's Facebook page, and you will find this extraordinary 8-minute soliloquy about how everybody's against him. I should explain, Jack Warner is the disgraced former head of CONCACAF. He's from Trinidad and Tobago. He left FIFA in 2011. He was thrown out. He's one of the people named in the indictments. But he goes on this incredible rant, basically accusing that, like, you know, I did no worse than everybody else at FIFA, so if you're going to go after me, you got to go after everybody else. And then he says, see, look, this is a plot by the US, and FIFA already caving in, because they're going to hold a special World Cup in 2015 in the United States. And he cites as his evidence a newspaper called The Onion. I don't know if you're familiar with The Onion. The Onion is a satirical newspaper. The news in The Onion is not real. So this is kind of the level that we're at, and we can all joke about that. But I wanted to get a sense, without getting too technical in the ins and outs, because I'm assuming it would bore all of you. Oh, you're laughing. Are you not bored? Do you want to talk FIFA committees? And
I love Exco.
Okay, now... But
FIFA Congress is my cup final.
Sepp Blatter was re-elected president of FIFA, right? We're all clear why he keeps getting re-elected. He continues getting re-elected because he's very popular in certain parts of the world that are perhaps slightly less preoccupied with corruption and slightly more preoccupied with paying the bills. And Sepp Blatter has always been very good to them, and there's a whole historical context to it as well, because the guy who was president before Blatter was Joao Havelange, but the guy before him was Stanley Rouse, who was this adorable man who, of course, backed the apartheid regime in South Africa and came up with such brilliant ideas when the whole world was boycotting South Africa because of the apartheid era, said, well, no, they really should be included in the World Cup. And when people didn't like that, it says, oh, I have an idea. Why don't they play? We can play one World Cup with black players and one World Cup with white players. And, you know, these were kind of solutions he came up with. So you can kind of see how, relative to that, especially in Africa and in Asia, somebody like Blatter would be popular because he devolved power.
That's all well and good, but is it not a bit insulting? You will all have followed this in infinitely more detail than I have.
You were only on your honeemoon, so...
Is it not a bit insulting?
I'm surprised you weren't streaming from FIFA.com all week.
Okay, she's a big fan of the live FIFA stream. Is it not a bit insulting to the African nations to suggest that they can't work out that things like the Goal Project are not entirely dependent on Sepp Blatter? I refuse to believe that every single sort of Congress member from an African country is thinking, oh well, if we don't elect Blatter, they won't give us any more money. These people aren't stupid. Jack Warner seems like he's a bit stupid, but other than him, I refuse to believe the majority of people aren't stupid.
So there's two factors, I think, to answer that question. The first one is that confederations are very big on block voting.
Like in Eurovision.
Exactly. No, but even...
Not UEFA this week.
What?
Not UEFA last week.
No, but they want it to be. And Platini's angry, and I can guarantee you there will be repercussions for some countries like France, say, who didn't
back
Platini's candidate.
Yep.
But obviously, if you can block vote, it gives you as a confederation more power, right? So that's been kind of the thing with Africa, that Issa Hayatou, who's the head of the African Confederation, delivers, 54, 56 votes, however many they are. The other thing, I think people have realized that the way you get a lot of these countries to support you isn't by going on and on and on about corruption and Heidi Blake and Andrew Jennings and how many documents did the AFC sell to you so that you could expose all this malfeasance, because a lot of these people are pretty cynical and they kind of assume that everybody's corrupt anyway. But the way to do it is to say, listen, corruption costs you money. Corruption, waste, money that goes to build, you know, Jack Warner's swimming pool is money that doesn't go back to in development. And that's why, like, Prince Ali made the point that development money to that part of the world was actually going to increase. No, they look at UEFA, right? And UEFA gives a lot of money back. But by the same token, UEFA's biggest money maker is the Champions League. Is that money equally divided? No. Where does it go? It goes to the wealthiest clubs in the wealthiest countries. And if I'm Burundi, I might say, I'll probably never qualify for the World Cup. And who's to say, you know, Germany or the U.S. or some country that does very well in the World Cup or has a very big TV contract, and to say, listen, we supply most of your TV revenue. Shouldn't we get it back rather than these people in Burundi who, you know, supply squat? I think that's the issue.
Well, Blatter's been very clever. People forget that. He looks after his constituents. He's the ultimate politician.
He's the president of everybody.
Why waste time trying to convince a cynical Europe that you're squeaky clean? You don't need to do it, so why waste time? He's devoted his time to making sure he's expanded football into areas where they didn't have it, and proving to them that if you embrace football, you will get money to build infrastructure, which doesn't just mean building a football stadium. It means building up facilities around those stadiums, homes, water, irrigation. There are whole communities reliant totally on what they see as the wonder that is Blatter. He's been incredibly clever about it. It might start to unravel now, but he's been there a long time doing it well.
Actually, first, Julia, you mentioned it. France did not, just for those who are curious, Platini obviously is French.
Yeah.
And he delivered Euro 26. This is the part I don't understand. He delivered Euro 2016 to France. He lobbied hard for it.
Yeah.
But then the president of the French Federation, Mr. Legrand, is that his name?
Yeah, Christmas Legrand.
He ends up backing Sepp Blatter. He says he's going to vote for Blatter, and he goes, presumably votes for Blatter.
Yeah.
Supposedly because he wants the 2019 World Cup in France, some sort of gratitude for that.
Yeah, we think so.
What's the deal with this guy? Like,
weird, really weird. He's same age as Blatter. He's very political as well in France. He's always, you know, done things to make sure that he was on top of everything. He led Guingamp, his hometown, his club. He was mayor of the city, and you know, went to.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
To the league and to the federation, and was always very successful and by being very manipulative and everything. And I just think him and Blatter are friends. They've been friends for a long time. And I just think that he just went for his mate.
Do you find it hard to swallow this sort of narrative of Platini being the white knight and the champion of reform? He was like that with Blatter for years and years. They only fell out when Blatter reneged on his pledge to stand down for Platini to take over, which was the plan 4 years ago. Blatter changed his mind. They've since fallen out. Platini also voted for Qatar because Sarkozy told him to.
Yeah.
So his attempt to kind of paint himself as the sort of champion of transparency and reform is sort of rankles a bit, to be honest. It'll be fascinating to see what he does this week in Berlin and if he can, you know, get the European team back together again, because I think he's going to struggle.
When you say put the European team back together, what do you mean?
To unite Europe against
FIFA.
To form a cohesive front in Europe against FIFA. Which, how's he going to get the Russians involved, for example?
Well, I don't think he will get the Russians involved.
No.
I
mean, neither the French.
What would you like him to do? What could he do?
Well, I don't think we can do anything, as Alison suggested. I think Greg Dyke thinks he knows what he can do.
Yeah,
well, Greg Dyke, along with many people, suffers from delusions of grandeur. I think we've just finally realised, after years of trying to win World Cups, that England are basically irrelevant in the sort of FIFA landscape. And having realised that, I think
we might
realise quite soon that Europe is irrelevant as well. It's only 50 countries, 18 of them voted for Sepp. So what can UEFA do? The talk of boycott is fanciful. Who's going to walk away from the World Cup?
Do you not think as well that this is the thing that has always sort of got me about all the FIFA nonsense, and no one's saying it's right or that it's good or we should, you know, be happy with it or whatever. But to the average fan, even in Europe, it doesn't really affect them who's in charge of FIFA and who's giving backhanders to who does it. I mean, all right, England aren't going to get the World Cup, but to be honest, even if it was a level playing field, I'm not sure England would get the World Cup because there are plenty of other countries out there who can host the World Cup. If say you've got the Germans, the Dutch, the Italians on board, and said, right, four or five of the major nations in world football are going to boycott the World Cup because we are objecting to FIFA's corruption.
And the US and Japan.
And
Australia.
Fine. So all seven. Fine. Great. Lovely, brilliant, kind of, aren't we great? Aren't we pure? Isn't everything we do fantastic? I don't know if fans would accept that if it was just to get rid of some of a corruption that I don't think they think really affects them. I think there's a core of people who are really bothered by it, and as they should be. But fans who just want to watch England in the World Cup, are they that fussed?
Okay, so this being the case, Alison, do you absolutely mean, are you as negative about the possibilities of a boycott or a statement or a guy who I think is really good but works for a different newspaper, but I'll name check him anyway, named Ian Herbert? He wrote a piece saying that the players could make a difference if active players, active managers took a stand. Is that being fanciful?
I'm sure it would make a huge difference, but it's not going to happen because the wonder that is football transcends all. Ironically, what the past week's events have shown is how in a minority states in Europe are when they get, and in America, get so upset about corruption. Corruption is a very covers a wide range of things. It's not just about the seedy backhander. There's much more to it than that that goes on. It's about promises and who you know and power and the good things that come out of it, like helping communities just live healthier lives because they've got money that they didn't have before. And the remarkable thing is, amidst all the seediness, at the end of every 4 years, there is a wonderful, wonderful event that is run incredibly smoothly. And there are never any boycotts. It is, no player ever, ever speaks politically before, during or after a World Cup.
I think you'll find Diego Maradona did and has done many times. Also, he's not taken extremely seriously.
Romario.
Exactly.
Romario.
Oh. Yeah, Romario.
Yeah, after he retires and he's got congressional immunity, you know, yeah, that's slightly different.
I think England should push hard for a boycott. Get all the big countries, Brazil, Argentina, Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, everybody for the boycott. And at the last minute, they drop out of the boycott. And they go to the World Cup. They're the only big team in the World Cup. They win it. After 100 years, they win it.
That's an amazing idea. Because remember last time, like David Bernstein, like they ended up abstaining, and he gives a speech. It's kind of like, ha-ha, from the safety of my situation. He's like those sort of like Twitter trolls. Like, you know there's not going to be any consequences because you're not doing anything serious. But in the current landscape, if they did move, I think you could stage an alternative World Cup, and I think you could get the money to make it significant, and I think you could damage the current World Cup enough that it would force FIFA to the table.
So what would be the tipping point? How many countries would you need and who get credible? Because as Alison says, football is unique. It's a truly global sport. We've seen splits in other sports, like cricket or whatever, in various codes of rugby. They go off and play their own thing, the Packer Circus in the 70s, but that was like seven countries, so you could set up your own little league.
And right.
How can you get the beauty of the World Cup is it's the World Cup. Once it ceases to involve everyone, it's not the same.
Well, A, you could still invite everybody, and obviously people under Blatter's thumb wouldn't come. But I think if you had a hardcore of major rights holders, major markets going from east to west, Japan, Korea, Australia. I think Japan you can bring on board. Australia is on board. Korea maybe slightly sketchier. You try China, they'd say no.
Who from South America?
I think Uruguay is almost nailed on. I mean, they came out in favor of Prince Ali.
As did Argentina, didn't they? Argentina voted Ali.
Yes, but it's a bit like they kind of said, yeah, well, maybe we did, maybe we didn't. It gets unclear. But there is the mood in South America. I mean, you certainly have a shot with both Argentina and Brazil. I mean, Brazil, you have a situation where the last four people running Brazilian football, one of them's dead, one of them's in prison, one of them's indicted, and the fourth is a fugitive, right?
So, have you seen the footage of Marin taking the medal from the kid? Marin, who was is either president now or president last but one of the CBF?
Last but one, maybe?
Last but one. Yeah. Handing out medals at, like, a kid's football tournament. And there's footage of him, like, just pocketing, like, pocketing a medal.
Yeah, he was also involved with a military junta, which was less funny.
But there's a lot of genuine anger in South America. There's a lot of the people involved in the bribery scandal are taking South American money.
Of course.
There's genuine anger across South America.
We should be clear on this, that the money that these people were the guys who were indicted, we should be clear, too, that these people were invited. The money that they were taking was money from their confederation. So CONCACAF money, CONMEBOL money. It's not like they were stealing money from the FIFA coffers, necessarily, although it would have presumably trickled down. But yeah, you get the U.S., I think, in Europe. Germany, Holland, Italy will follow the wind. Portugal, I think, is a decent shout. Once you get a tipping point,
you get 16
at that
teams.
Stage, 16 you know, what are you going to do? Have a World Cup with, like, you know, but Russia playing Nigeria?
There's a massive difference between voting for another candidate in a secret ballot and then walking out of a World Cup. I mean,
but you threaten to do it. You set it up. You sell the TV rights. You make it all conditional. You bring them to the table. If you believe in it, that's at some point you have to do. You have to have a credible threat. Right, if you're going to go down that road. And you have to consider the repercussions. One obvious repercussion is that we would be in an enormous, enormous legal mess when it comes to transfers, player status, and so on. And I actually think that might be a positive. Because right now, FIFA runs international transfers. Personally, I think the individual confederations should run them. And FIFA should just kind of monitor from a distance and resolve disputes. That would be another huge move, I think, towards greater transparency. You could bring stuff like that to the table. And you could negotiate if there's a political will to do that. And frankly, you know, you don't need 54. In fact, I think it's better if we kind of show that there is some level of dissent in Europe and not everybody's on board with it. There's not everybody just like marching in lockstep as happens, in other confederations.
Who would Panini go for?
Sorry?
Panini World Cup with their bag.
Double their profit. They got two
Panini albums and stickers.
Can you imagine?
I'm up for that.
That would keep you busy. No, I mean, you could have.
How much? You've got a 6 year old son, it cost you a fortune.
It cost me, last summer, it cost me an arm.
64, and then you could have two World Cups. You'd have 64 teams. 64 nations. That'd be, I mean.
It's a lot of swap deals to do in Paninis.
Do you think that if we had two World Cups, Scotland would get into one?
No.
And you're allowed to mark Scotland because.
I am. I'm half Scottish, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. And who is going to lead this campaign for an alternative clean World Cup? When the only person who went up against Blatter was. A relatively young, unknown prince.
From
we
Joe.
Had very little charisma. You need someone massive football.
All right. Greg Dyke, Diego Maradona, David Ginola. That's your three. That's your triumvirate.
The A team.
To be fair to the relatively unknown guy, he has been a FIFA vice president for the last 4 years.
Lacks charisma.
Okay, but I mean, it doesn't make him a bad administrator, right?
No, but he's not.
Probably helps, doesn't it? Not having charisma to be an administrator.
I just didn't you feel he just ended up looking quite isolated and.
He got 73 votes, which I think is pretty
much
remarkable.
Better than he thought he was going to do, yeah.
But they were anti-Blatter votes, they weren't pro him as a candidate votes. You need somebody. I just feel a way to oust Blatter with an alternative World Cup, you need someone remarkably
now
famous with. With everyone adores.
Now it can be revealed. There were three candidates, obviously, standing against Blatter: Luis Figo, Michael Van Praag, and Prince Ali. Luis Figo and Michael Van Praag stepped aside because they figured that they would have less chance of winning than Prince Ali. They certainly felt that Prince Ali was their best shot, and that's why they all got together and backed him and put their weight behind him. Obviously, it doesn't help convince France, and he only got 73 votes. But you know, it's not a bad result given where he started from. One last thing on the indictments: the U.S. Department of Justice, there's crimes committed that you can use this legislation to go and arrest people in other countries. I thought that was fascinating, and it kind of occurred to me that the U.S. can do it because they have nukes and they're the U.S. I don't know that another country could do it.
They're really political. I think someone has to do it. If you don't have you can't have the entire kind of liberal Western world bottling all international decisions or getting involved. Someone has to take a bit of responsibility. And I'm not saying the Americans are perfect or that they're that we should all ape their society. But someone ultimately has to take some form of responsibility for maintaining law and justice and what have you.
So let's move on to some quick hits. Christian Benteke's contract is winding down, and there are plenty of reports suggesting Villa value him at £35 million. Alison, if you were the transfer committee at Liverpool, you'd be five different people, and you'd all be men, but you'd also be able to decide whether he ought to be coming to Anfield. Your verdict?
Stroke of genius, because not only would Rodgers make Benteke a better person. He has identified him as the ideal candidate to replace Emre Can at right back.
Wow! I get take some snarkiness there.
Last show of the season, but one answer that one.
Are you being so mean to Rodgers because you have some inside information that he will not be the Liverpool manager in a couple of weeks?
Indeed, yeah.
All right, quick poll. Hands up. Who thinks Brendan Rodgers will be the Liverpool manager next season? Aha. Uh-huh. So it's split down the middle. It's 2-2.
Can I say something about... I'm not on these quick hits.
You're not. You weren't supposed to be here.
I'm not invited. Alison, I don't think Rodgers should be Liverpool manager, but I think he will be. I like Liverpool's transfer committee's approach of signing players who are now Premier League proven. If you want to sign players exclusively who are proven in the Premier League, why do you need scouts? Julian's son, Rafa, who I've met and is a lovely person, can tell you the names of four or five good players in the Premier League. You don't need to employ people to do it. So I implore FSG, if you're going to sign players who are Premier League proven, sack all of your scouts and reinvest the money in, I don't know, FIFA.
Academy development or something.
That's an idea, but they're not really going to do that. Have they said they're only going to buy Premier League proven players?
That appears to be the priority, yes.
Yeah, there's real value in that, isn't there?
Yeah.
The season is over and clubs have those old postseason tours. Manchester City are in the US, Spurs and Chelsea are in Australia, they've been somewhere else in Asia in the meantime. Hughesy, are postseason tours even worse than preseason tours? And I'm assuming you've been on several. Tell us some humorous tales and anecdotes in 25 seconds or less.
I haven't been on any.
You've never been on a tour?
Unlike a post-season tour, we don't tend to value them because they're pretty pointless, and by the end of the season, who cares?
Okay, so it's not like it's a great opportunity. Everybody's relaxed and hanging out, and you get to
spend
quality time.
Well, I would like to go on holiday to Sydney for a week, but funnily enough, the Times don't want to pay for it.
Is anybody covering these tours?
Not really, no. I think Jiggins has gone to stalk Harry Kane.
I think if they're relatively close by, some of the tabloids send. But the reason people don't pre-season tours is just there are interview opportunities with new players or new managers. Those, by their very nature, don't exist on a post-season tour, so no point out.
It's just a corporate commercial shindig, really.
Newcastle are pursuing two very different men for their newly vacant manager's job, Patrick Vieira and Steve McClaren. And presumably they'll be pursuing somebody else after they both say no. But Julian, who do you think is a better fit and is either actually viable?
Steve who? I've got no time for him. I think Patrick would be a good option. I would like to see Patrick there. I would like to see him in the Premier League as a manager. I'm not sure it would work, but I would like to see him. I'd be curious to see him. I'm just not sure he can work with Ashley, Lee Charney and all that.
Do you think he would take it? Because if I'm Vieira sitting at Man City in a great position, one of the best run clubs in the world, why would you go to Newcastle?
Because he can stay at City and not have an opportunity for the next 10 years. Whereas, you know, you go to Newcastle then, you do a good job.
It's a tough first job, isn't it?
And it's a tough first job. And I think he saw Makelele, I mean, his friend, go to Bastia. And he thought at the time, that's a great idea for Bastia, great for Makelele. You know, he was an assistant before, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And after 12 games, he was sacked.
But isn't...
And Patrick went like, oh, well, maybe it's actually not that great.
But isn't Bastia also a bit of a zoo of a club?
Yeah, no. Yeah, it was. I think there was... But yeah, it would be a tough first job. But then, you know, so what do? You go for Newcastle as a first job, or do you wait for a bigger one, knowing that it's maybe more difficult to go straight into City? I don't know.
Leicester City players who nobody has ever heard of film themselves in what the papers described as an orgy, and one of them is heard using a racially sensitive term. Is this a mountain or a molehill?
It's very depressing. There is this thing where it's cool if you're in a team sport to all have sex with the same woman because it's supposed to bond you together. Throw in a bit of racism and you've got footballers on tour at their very worst, and I thought we were getting better at educating them.
It is a reason.
Son of a manager as well.
It is a reason to go on a post-season tour, though, isn't it?
It's not so much the orgy. I mean, that's obviously pretty vile and disgusting. But the stupidity of then sending a footage to all your mates, pass it to the newspapers, is just extraordinary.
The Women's World Cup will be held this summer, as will the European Under-21s and the Copa America. Hughesy, please rank the three in terms of what grabs your interest the most.
Well, I'll be covering the 21s in the Czech Republic, so I guess I've got a professional interest in that. Beyond that, being honest, I would be amazed if I watched a minute of the other two.
Okay, anybody dissent?
Because you don't want to, or you won't have much time. Probably you won't have much time.
Yeah, we asked you what would interest you, no?
Neither, really.
Would you rather go and watch the cricket?
Pretty much. Summer, I'm comedy old-fashioned, but summer's for cricket, Wimbledon, and a bit of athletics.
And that's just what Hughesy does. It's not just what he watches.
Any dissent on this?
And the Under-20 World Cup as well is on.
Okay,
that's cool as well. I think the Copa America will be fantastic this year. Really, really, really fantastic. It's going to be a bit late, so you know the missus will be in bed. You know, you can have the kids will be in bed, the wife will be in bed, and you just the husband.
I'll watch all three.
Thank you. That's a mature approach, Alison.
Ditto, especially the Women's World Cup.
Well, did you just say that because we expect that? I purposely threw the question of all the Women's World Cup at Hughesy so I wouldn't pigeonhole. Do you really have an interest in this Women's World Cup?
Yeah, I've interviewed some of the players. I was really impressed with Germany when I went to watch England v Germany at Wembley for that record sellout match, and I've put money on Germany's women to win the World Cup, so I do have an interest.
She has a betting interest.
It matters more if there's money on it.
Exactly.
But it's later in the night.
The moral of today's podcast
is... Night.
With the Copa America?
No,
the Women's
World Cup in Canada. So, you know, you'll have to either stay up or walk up.
America, actually, I'm going out there.
Like 1994.
You going?
Yeah. No, I'm not going.
Oh. It's not that bad, because I think it's like 5 o'clock local.
The Women's World Cup is... some games are like in the middle of the night, or really late.
Dani Alves is 32 years old. You can sign him on a free transfer. Julien, how do you think this one plays out? And would he make sense as an instant fix right back, say at Manchester United?
It's like you were reading Community Chest in Monopoly, wasn't it? The delivery of that one.
It is nearing that time.
It is your birthday. Collect £15 from each Premier League player.
My Rafa has the kids version, And one of the cards is, you've eaten too many sweets, pay 1 million. That's
there's a moral there as well.
In an age of sugar addiction and diabetes,
exactly.
That's an important lesson.
I like that.
Is that like the weird French kids version?
Because no
my, kids, my kids have the kids version to Monopoly Junior, and there's no millions. It's all just like $1, $2.
No, it's 1M.
Inflation
is just 1 million.
It's one Monopoly pound.
It's one Monopoly.
It's 1 million.
One Monopoly.
We put a million in the house. That's how we roll. That's how we roll. We call it millions.
Jules has got the oligarchs version.
Yeah, exactly. We've got the Roman and...
So, Danny Alves.
Yes, I think it would be a good idea for United. He still can't defend, but I think he had a good season. You know, I think offensively he's still a very good option, and I think he would be a good player to have in a squad for free. And his ex-wife is his agent, which I find amazing, so...
I think it'd actually be a huge loss for
definitely
for Barcelona. I don't think they quite. I think he's still a key player for them. And
is there anything that we don't know in the negotiation though? It looks all a bit weird, you know.
I'm sure in the end it'll get done.
I thought he was going to sign, wasn't he?
Weird. Yeah. And
yeah, I'm sure it'll get done in the end. But you know, it's a talking point.
It is.
So I can contribute. I'm going to do this one. Gab, one for you. Rafa Benitez said farewell to Naples last night. Did he do so on a high?
Not really, because they lost 4-2 at home.
Good game.
In a tremendous game against Lazio. They were 2-0 down. They battled back to 2-2. A guy got sent off for Lazio. And then Gonzalo Higuain, whom Rafa cruelly substituted at halftime the week before, was still so upset that he took his penalty, Jason Puncheon style, and skied it out of the stadium. And then the wheels came off, and Lazio scored twice and won 4-2. That means that they finished the season in fifth place. I think it's kind of stupid to look at Rafa Benitez and say, like, let's judge everything on his last game of the season, but that's inevitably how it's going to play out. He spent a large amount of money in net terms. They had a tremendous run in the Europa League this year, but then he kind of threw it all away. They won the Coppa Italia last year. What I find most interesting about Rafa Benitez is that this is a totally different Rafa Benitez. This is a Napoli side with horrible defense, not much organization. They managed to concede 54 goals in 38 games, which is an absurdo amount by any stretch. So I'm really curious to see whether he's undergone some kind of change, or whether it was just a weird season, or if his football philosophy has somehow evolved into this. But they did like him in Naples. That's all we've got time for this week, and indeed this season. Many, many thanks to my guests today, Alison Rudd, Julian Lawrence, Matt Hughes, and, unexpectedly, Rory K. Smith. Many, many thanks to also the guests who've joined us in the course of a year. I'm wondering if I should name them, but I'll probably forget somebody, but it's still nice to be name-checked. So, George Culkin, my favorite guest of all, Ollie K., that guy who kind of looks like Rory and went to the same school like as Rory, but whose name I don't recall.
Ben Machel.
Ben Machel, yes, your doppelganger. I'm forgetting people, aren't I? Tony Evans, Clive Petty.
Evo.
No, I don't think we've had Tony Barrett this year, have we?
We're not.
No.
We've had
Matt Dickinson, yes. We've had Matt Dickinson on the
Max
call.
Rushton.
Yes,
he was amazing.
When I wasn't here.
Yeah, he was.
Exactly.
Well, it was me, Hughes, and Jules for that one. It was
the show of the year.
Definitely the show of the year.
Downloads for sure.
Max Rushton asked the best question I've ever heard anyone ask a football journalist.
What was that?
He said to Hughes, "You've been at that was like Arsenal Chelsea," and he said, "You were at Arsenal Chelsea on Saturday," and Hughes, "You went, yep." And Max Rushton went, "Did you have a nice time?"
And there you go. Hitting all the sports takes all sorts. So. Thank you to, how could we forget, James Scowcroft, the thinking man's ex-footballer, and Tony Cascarino, the other ex-footballer. Jim Proudfoot.
Oh, yeah, Jim. We had Jim
Proudfoot, gold standard, I think, my second, actually probably my favorite English football commentator. I mentioned Clive Petty, let's mention him again, because he's our boss. We've had Stuart Robson on, man beloved by Arsenal fans far and wide. I have said Cascarino, thank you. The reason you're hearing this is because I have a Dave McGuire in my ear. Of course, James Ducker from the Great Northwest.
Sam Munnery.
Sam Munnery, of course, the person who's on the sports desk. And
the person who's on the sports desk.
And he's on the online sports desk and made another good contribution. And of course, thank you, special thank you to our producer, Dave McGuire.
I'm the other bloke.
Sorry?
Yeah, and what about Phil, who does it when Dave's not here?
Yes, thank you to Phil Brown, who does it when Dave's not here. All right, thank you to everybody who's still voting for Dave McGuire this year, not just Phil Brown, but the other ones. We appreciate all your support and feedback. Inshallah, we'll be back next year. Members get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of their subscription. I've noticed we've passed the 400,000 subscribers mark on thetimes.co.uk after it was stuck on 389,000 for seemingly 5 years. if you're not a member yet, you can take our £1 digital trial today. You can just search Times Sport online. And it's all for your viewing pleasure, your entertainment, and your education. See you next season, we hope. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.